Broadcasting live from the beautiful Morningstar Golfers Club, it's time for a fairway side edition of Point Taken for the 2026 Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Classic. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Broad.
And welcome, that'd be our cue.
That'd be us.
Yes, on a windswept Morningstar Golf Course.
I was expecting to be sweating by now, and I'm not.
Yeah, it's weird because it's cloudy.
And it's a little cloudy.
Which takes the...
The air is a little thick. It almost feels like it's going to rain, but I don't think it's supposed to.
No, not today, but it is definitely a gorgeous... I mean, we're up on the platform of the clubhouse looking out over the 18th. There's some tee boxes close by. It's a gorgeous day, and we've done this for 6 years.
Have you been to this golf... golf course before?
Yes.
It is gorgeous. And the neighborhood around it.
It's a very challenging course, but I actually had one of my best rounds ever here so many years ago.
Oh.
I wouldn't be able to shoot that today, I can guarantee you that.
But yeah, this is beautiful. The neighborhood's beautiful. Happy to be here, man.
Yeah, so we got a lot of great partners out with us today. All our great partners are here with us on WTMJ for our show and all the shows. So thanks for all of that generosity and teamwork. And it's just a fun day. And the fact that it's not raining is always a blessing because we've had great luck in having it not rain on these six annual events. So cool for that. We start the show. We're going to have Jim Santel, our legal expert, join us about 10:15. But breaking Supreme Court news. The big one everyone was waiting for, and I don't know what to make of the fact that they released that one last, birthright citizenship.
Especially since it's what most people expected.
Yeah.
After what the oral arguments were, most people thought that they would uphold birthright citizenship. That is what they did.
Yeah, I would like to see 9-0, but we didn't get that. But it's 6-3, basically. There's I'm going to have to ask Jim, because there's some weird... Some of the justices both agreed and disagreed in their opinions, so in their dissenting opinions, so I'm not sure if you can count that as a half vote or not. That's what a lot of the commentators were trying to do. But basically, the court said that you cannot say to someone if they're born in the United States that you're not a citizen. You are a citizen of the United States, which I think I know your thoughts, and I'm a fan of this idea, and they struck down the executive order, which what's kind of started all this stuff by the president. It's one of those days where I think... I don't want to use it calms the situation because there's so much going on that we could talk about in respect to this issue. But I think at least it calms the nation in the fact that for that right, those people, that's a given. You don't have to worry about it. And another question for Jim is, does this settle it now? Because this Supreme Court, it seems like they can always sort of twist and turn on some of these decisions they've made previously 95 years ago yesterday or, you know, a couple hundred years ago. Is this the end of the road for this question? That's going to be a question I'm going to have for Jim Santel. Well, I mean, what do you think about today?
I'm relieved because I feel like, as you said, you probably know where I stand on it. So I think that is that and the mail-in voting yesterday felt like a win. I am looking forward to talking to Jim about the campaign finance ruling that came out today, because that's for something that is so wildly popular amongst most when you poll on this issue as far as reforming campaign finance and getting big money out of campaigns. Does not seem like we're moving in the right direction with that because, you know, money is speech. And, you know, and I think it's interesting as far as what this opens up as far as states' rights when it comes to how they allow transgender athletes to compete or not compete. And so I definitely have a lot of follow-up questions for Jim when we come back.
Yeah, the court held that schools can determine eligibility for women's and girls' sports teams based on their biological sex. So that's a big one that Jim will certainly talk to us about. It is the sixth annual WTMJ Golf Classic. Thanks to Pella Windows and Doors, a great partner and sponsor of all the things we do at WTMJ. And it's one of those days that I always enjoy. It's going to be a day filled with hopefully a little bit of sunshine. We're going to get out and golf after noon, after our show's done. And then, of course, Greg and Jessica will sit in these chairs. And we're going to go meet everybody.
Try to have some fun.
Try to hit the ball straight.
I already saw Rose Gray this morning.
I did. She's just back from Ireland.
Looked great.
Or Ireland or Scotland?
Is it Scotland? Ireland. I said... That I last as of last night, because did you see this, that the Scottish fans have put out billboards in Boston because the Scottish fans did what the Packer fans did when they went to London, and they outdrank the Boston bars. And so apparently now Scottish fans have bought a billboard that says, Boston bars, you tried. And so my husband now wants to go to Scotland.
You know what else I'm learning about Scotland? They got a lot of money.
they have a lot of money?
Yeah, they're traveling. They're staying here. They're drinking these places dry. They have a lot of, and they're putting billboards.
Well, apparently. I mean, that's all the people who have managed, because it's not, I said this.
Not cheap.
Mike has decided that he wants to go to a game. He asked me last night, he goes, how would you feel if I went to a game by myself?
Where's the closest game, Kansas
City? I think he's looking at Boston.
Yeah,
and so he's looking at the cheapest ticket he could find for under $2,300 was, I think, around $1,300. And he's like, I bought it. I can always sell it. But at least I bought it, because he wants, as an event planner, he wants to go see what this event is like. But you think about, there's that many people from all across the world.
That's a great thing.
Spending that kind of money to travel, to buy those tickets, to enjoy themselves. And it has been the highlight of watching all of these clips and all of these fans celebrating.
That's a big
and now
upset.
The games are getting, now the games really matter, right?
Yeah. Do or die, right?
And the two of the games yesterday, the Morocco, Netherlands, and Paraguay.
Germany. Out.
I watched those games that ended in kickoffs, or kickouts, penalty kicks.
Yeah.
Not penalty kicks. This is me, like the ending when they're doing penalty kicks, and like it was 3-3 because two got saved, one
got
missed.
That is so mesmerizing.
Yeah, it was incredible. And so it's been very fun. And so Scotland.
Yeah.
You've been to Scotland.
I just went last summer with Gene Miller and his whole crew.
Recommend?
Highly.
It's
a gorgeous country, a lot of cool stuff, and a lot of great golf. Welcome, as I said, to the 6th annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Classic Golf Outing. It is windy. You can hear that on the mics, but you know we're going to have fun. After the break, our legal expert, Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney for Southeastern Wisconsin, will join us to break down the three big decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court today. That's all coming up next on Point Taken. We are broadcasting live from Morningstar out here in Waukesha at the 6th annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic. Let's go right to our legal expert. He joined us yesterday on some of the decisions released by the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. And today, the final ones of this year until the fall session begins in October. Jim Santel joins us, former U.S. Attorney for Southeast Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Steve, Kristen, good to be with you once again. Three big rulings, as you just said, and concluding this Supreme Court's term, just under 70 opinions altogether.
How does that fall for what they typically, their workload? Is that about normal?
It's about normal. It's a little bit higher than last year, previous years. They've typically been teetering somewhere around 60 to 70. So this is fairly typical, as they say, a little bit higher. It does not, for what it's worth, include the various so-called shadow docket emergency applications and other things that they do on a regular basis, which we hear about. But these are the principal so-called merits docket decisions. And today, not surprisingly, no big surprises. We got campaign finance, and we got transgender women in sports, and perhaps the big one going into the 4th of July holiday, birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment.
All right. Well, since birthright citizenship was last, that's usually what they use. You save the biggest for the last. And so it was 194 pages. Put that in context as far as this decision being that long. How much longer is that than typical rulings?
That's quite long, especially when you look at one of the dissents, which is, of course, Justice Thomas, who goes to great length. I'm still counting. I think he's in excess of 90 pages on his dissent. And again, the principal dispute, the majority opinion here is about 26 pages, and you've got some very nice language, obviously written by the Chief Justice, to send us into the 4th of July. He talks about the importance of this basic right and describes that in a way that plenty of you can read while you're cooking your hot dogs and bratwurst, those kinds of things. But it plainly is not surprising, given what we heard at the time of the oral argument. The upshot is that the president suffers a loss here. His executive order from way back in his first day in office is found illegal, unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court basically embraces a case called Wong Kim Ark, among other things, and says that, yes, indeed, if you are born here in America, in the United States of America, you do, in fact, get citizenship, and the Supreme Court today reaffirms that quite definitively. Not surprising, we get some good language from the Chief Justice, said citizenship then and now, he's talking about some history, was the right to have rights, to freely participate in our political community. The framers of the 14th Amendment extended that promise to every freeborn person in this land. We keep that promise today. That's the Chief Justice and others, including Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Amy Coney Barrett, also joining on that. For what it's worth, Kavanaugh does kind of a split down the middle. He says, I join in the results, but based upon a statutory authority and not a constitutional authority. Bottom line is, you've got, depending on how you count this, a 5 or 6-3 in a direction that's not surprising.
Is this the end of this question? Is it settled now? Is anything going to be settled in the current legal climate of our country?
It certainly should be, and of course I say that a little bit humorously in my tone of my voice, only because you wonder today if anything is truly settled when we talk about the other case involving Title IX and equal protection. That matter involving transgender sports, probably not settled. This one should be, and you'd like to think that, okay, now we are reaffirming what the Constitution has been understood to say for many, many years. This should be the end of it, and gives a sigh of relief, frankly, for many, many people in America who are looking this in various states of their own citizenship, says, yes, indeed, the law will not change. President, on his executive order, once again, is mistaken. This, what used to be a fringe theory out there, is now relegated, to a fringe status once again. The decisiveness, Steve, I would think, of this opinion, when you read what the Chief Justice says, what the others concur in, should bring this to a decisive conclusion. But, of course, we're going to get lots and lots of commentary on this, and certainly there are going to be those people out there who are going to parse through what the dissenters have said, including this 91-page opinion from Clarence Thomas, and say, aha, they're abandoning history. And that's really what the attack is between the two of them, a real reinterpretation and a disagreement between the justices about what our history has been all about. That's the basis upon which the debate will continue, hopefully inside courts.
And that was going to be my question, as far as this 91-page dissent with Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito all writing dissenting opinions. But I know you haven't had time to necessarily parse through all of it, but what is the crux of why they dissented?
Right, and so they do go back, and again, you look at, it begins, for example, page 6, I begin with early American practices related to citizenship and nationality, which informs what the Citizen Clause means, and he then proceeds through the next 80-some pages, various sections, various aspects of this. The Citizenship Clause, he says, just like the Civil Rights Act, also excluded from citizenship the children of tribal Indians, meaning Indians whose tribes retain sovereign authority. That's just a sampling, Kristen, of what he does. He is going through history. Again, I won't say it may or may not be accurate in terms of all its precision, but he is describing very particular things. He's talking about individuals who are denied citizenship. The child of a woman named Mary Devereaux was denied citizenship being born in the United States in 1889. There is a huge amount of very particular history, and he says all of that leads to a result that does not support what the majority says. It is principally a reliance on history, again, coupled, he would plainly say, with 14th Amendment understanding.
All right, he is Jim Sentell, former U.S. attorney. We're going to come back and talk through the other two decisions that came out today, so stay with us on Point Taken.
Welcome back to the 6th Annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Classic Golf Outing. We are in Waukesha. Jim Sentell, our legal expert, joining us. Got a couple minutes left with Jim. There's two other big decisions. I know one of them combined a couple cases, and that had to do with, I think, the transgender rights decision. Right, Jim?
That's exactly right, having to do with a couple of states, in particular West Virginia. And the upshot there is that neither Title IX, which is, of course, the statutory authority that provides that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be included from participation, deny benefits in any educational program or activity getting federal assistance, no violation of Title IX in separating women's and men's sports deemed defined by biological sex, And also the big ticket item coming out of that is that there's no equal protection problem there. And so the Supreme Court basically says that the states can indeed limit, restrict the participation of transgender women in women's sports. The principal dissent by Sonia Sotomayor says she agrees on Title IX, but she says, I'd send this back for more exploration and explanation of the equal protection argument. And she says there's more to be discussed there before you dissolve what basically has been the decision by the Supreme Court here. So it is not surprising. We've got, again, a split court here making the determination states can do this. It is not the end of the cases because, of course, the question is, are they compelled to do so? That may well be the next case under equal protection and other theories that's out there.
Well, Jim, I was going to ask, so is this basically similar to Dobbs, where it's sending everything back to the states, so now it is up to state legislators and legislature to decide how to handle this topic?
It's got some real similarities to that. Again, basically tells these two states that they can, in fact, do this. Whether other states, they're not compelled to do it. Whether other states decide to do it, that's within their discretion. But that may well be the next case, Kristen, if, in fact, there is the argument made that under the Equal Protection Clause, states are compelled to prohibit transgender women. That's a slightly different question. That may be the next tranche of litigation coming up here.
Real quick, only about 30 seconds, the campaign finance decision, what does it say?
Yep, the Federal Election Campaign Act that coordinated expenditure limits violates the First Amendment and for that reason cannot stand. We've got Kavanaugh delivering the opinion of the court. We've got Kagan and other two, Sonia Sotomayor and Sanji Brown Jackson, dissenting. A big decision when it comes to campaign financing, basically a First Amendment violation if, in fact, the Federal Election Campaign Act is enforced in the way that it seems to be enforced.
Jim, now that all the legal decisions are made for this term, I think at some point we'll assemble the legal expert team that we have on Point Taken, Mary and everybody else, Matt O'Neill, and we'll bring him into studio and discuss the impact of all of these decisions. Thanks, Jim.
It's always a pleasure, my friends. Have a good day.
All right. Our legal expert, Jim Santel, former U.S. Attorney for Southeast Wisconsin. Big day.
Big day.
But that's it for this term. All right, so we have a great topic coming up, America 250. As you know, we're celebrating that across the country, local celebrations. Welcome to 6th Annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin, WTMJ Golf Classic. Kristen Bry.
Hello.
Yours truly, Steve Scafidi. On the course, we're looking over the 18th fairway and green. The sun has actually peaked out now because it was really cloudy. A little bit of wind, but that seems to be settling down a bit as we sort of warm up today. And we said it yesterday. We'll say it again today. Be careful. Drink a lot of fluids. We're doing that here, just broadcasting. We're not even exerting ourselves other than our really sharp brains.
Super sharp.
Super sharp on a Tuesday. Talking Tuesday to some extent. All right, we spent the first half hour talking about the breaking Supreme Court decisions. We're going to kind of move on, but in many ways connected to that story, America 250. We're all going to be celebrating that Saturday, 4th of July. I'll be at a couple parades, one right in front of my house and the other one in the city of Cudahy. Where do you go for the 4th?
We do the River West Parade, nice. Which is very fun. So we'll do that, and then we might bop down to, because, you know, Milwaukee was chosen as one of the major cities, and so I think Summerfest is going to have a lot going on, so we're going to bop down there for the afternoon. And then I think we're going to be at a friend's barbecue that evening. Fireworks also in our neighborhood at Gordon Park. So, you know, fairly traditional.
So we've spent some time last week and this week sort of leading up to this birthday for America, and a lot of the attention goes to Washington, D.C., which is fine, and, you know, that's where our country's centered politically. But I guess the question for me is, and we're going to spend some time on our podcast this week with our Friday guys, Bill McCosh and Joseph Pecky, looking at where we came from every 50 years in our country's history, and for me, more importantly, where we go in the next 50 years. But if I were to ask you, Kristen Bry, are we in a good place after 250 years as a country? And we'll kind of break down some of the factors that makes that decision. Are we in a good place after 250 years as a leading country in the world?
I think there's a lot of follow-up questions I have to that question.
Yeah,
so
course.
As far as, you mean like in comparison to a 250 years ago?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, turmoil, obviously American Revolution, so much uncertainty. Started with a few colonies, and then sort of the people of this country, thousands of people, all different kinds of people, because if you saw the Ken Burns thing, Native Americans and French citizens and people just coming from all over the place joining the fight against England. And it was,
or joining England.
Or joining, yeah, it's joining their side as well. It is sort of an amazing story, that one that's 250 years later, but two, we've seen so much in those 250 years.
But I guess I'll put it back on you. Sorry. When you say, are we in a good place, how do you define good?
By all the measures that I think we're going to talk about, things like civil rights, quality of life, public safety, health care, women's rights, pay inequities, and you know, the CEO salary question that becomes more and more prominent in our conversations about the economic injustice. But if you say to me, are we safer? I think so. We're protected. We have a strong military. I think that's probably a good thing. Public safety, I feel safe walking the streets of the city that I live in Oak Creek and work in Milwaukee. I feel safe. I walk down Wisconsin Avenue. I don't feel any risk. I go downtown at night. So I think public safety, we're safe. I mean, one of the question marks is health care. We're living longer, certainly. If you go to 1840, average adult lived to be like 35 years old.
So I think that's the thing that's really interesting about this question, because, you know, what is the bookend timeline that you're looking at? Is it from 1776? Is it from 1976? Is it from 2006? And then also looking at the trend lines, right, as far as where are we actually going? Because I think it's impossible to deny that over even 50 years and a lot of the measures you just talked about, things have trended forward. Then also, what is the trend line from 10 years ago about some things,
recent
right?
Recent history.
And I also think it's the shared definition of us wanting all of the same things. A lot, I think, there is there that we want all the same things. But as far as we refer back to just what happened with the decision around birthright citizenship, granted, some of these might be bots. Some of them might not be real people. But as I was reading some of the responses to SCOTUS blog, a very objective fact analysis resource to talk about legal rulings, the amount of people who are really upset about that, right? And so there's some people who don't agree on all of the civil rights as everyone defines them, that everyone should have access to those things. And so I think that is a question, is like, who's defining good? What is the definition? And what are the things that actually get us to a good place?
I used to ask this question, like, the average American, but what's the average American now? Like, how do you even define that? Everybody's so unique and different. Everyone has an opinion on everything. Everybody's an internet expert on everything, because we're all connected now in ways that we never used to be before. We didn't talk amongst ourselves. You can meet someone new on the internet, and a week later, they could be your best friend. That never used to happen.
It's funny. Have you ever seen those, I don't even know if they're polls, but the over-representation, when you ask someone, like, how big of a representation do you think the LGBTQ community is, or trans people, or immigrants, or people who live in cities, or live in, you know, like all these different demographics of people. And there is, when you ask someone what they think, it is such an over-representation of what the percentage of the population they actually make. Because think about this, how many people do you think have a college degree?
20%?
That is closer. Because in the world that I live in, so many of the people that I know have a college degree, but that is not the majority of United States citizens. So I think it is interesting, if you have to actually look at data, what is average? Because I think anecdotally, all of us would have a different image of what that looks like.
Yeah, I think there's just so many ways to measure. And I love the point you're making about recent history, because certainly much has changed since the rise of technology like AI, and certainly before that, access to the internet. That's changed everything. So we can talk amongst ourselves. We can see what other people are saying, certainly in a way that we never had that before. Before that, it was your community, your friends and family and neighbors. It's beyond that now. Everyone's your friends, family, neighbors, because you can connect in all those different ways. What do you think? Is there a way to measure this in the respect of the 250th anniversary of this country? Are we better off? And don't go all the way back to 1776.
Well, none of us were alive then.
Yeah. That,
but
and
I think,
the
I
fact
think the
that most things
I think
are
the,
better.
I think the 50, like 50 year, 25 year, especially for our listening audience, where a lot of the people who listen to us remember 1976, and like, what's gotten better in your point of view? What has gotten better? What has gotten worse? Are we closer to the founders' ideal of what we were supposed to be? 855-616-1620. He is Steve. I am Kristen. And this is Point Taken.
We are broadcasting live from the Morningstar Golfers Club. Beautiful course. I had my best round ever many years ago on this one.
What does that mean, best round ever?
Shot for 18 holes, lowest score.
Lowest score ever.
Yeah, they had 86 for me on a real challenging course. Yeah,
all right.
I couldn't do that today. I'd probably shoot 100, maybe a little better. Depends. And of course, the Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic. Gorgeous day. Wind is lighting up a little bit. I know you can hear some of that that wind noise. But we're outside, and to be outside broadcasting, talking about these issues is amazing.
There is something about being outside that is, like, I got home yesterday,
air.
And Mike was filling up the blow-up baby pool. Frankie was running around in her underwear, and I was like, this feels like summer.
You'll like this. I woke up so early this morning, and I had time before I had to come out here. I was repotting some of the plants that I grew from seed for you, so your asters and your Shasta daisies are ready to be transported to you. They're not big yet, because these are perennials, take a couple years,
yeah.
But they're probably, you know, looking good, so you'll get
ready to be transferred.
Yeah, so you get the flowers at the end of the summer, which
hey.
Is gorgeous. So that was what I was doing this morning. All right, we asked the question. You asked me specifically about 1976, my high school graduation year.
Yeah.
So I guess it depends what measure you're looking at, but I my quality of life's better because I was a college graduate. My parents were doing fine, and they raised four boys wonderfully in Cudahy and Oak Creek. So quality of life is better.
Interesting. So this, I just thought of this, and I never have asked you. How much of, at that age, were you a thoughtful person who thought about the world in the same way you think about it now?
No.
You were
not.
More of a classic 18-year-old boy?
No, I was a party guy.
Yeah.
My goal was to play ball or or have fun.
Because I think it's interesting. Even the unreliable narrator that any of us are of being able to look at a different point of our life and like, how did the country feel? And it's like obviously going to be through the lens of how you saw the world at that point. So like you can look back and you're like, I don't know, my life was pretty good.
Yeah.
But you probably weren't thinking about all these other types of people that existed in the country and how they were doing. And
compared to,
I think you, I would can say you are thoughtful now, but I don't think you've always thought about the world like that.
No, and keep in mind, I'm a high school graduate, moving out relatively young, getting a place of my own. And then I wasn't looking for a home. Now, so if you ask a home buyer in 1976, it was the time where there was some uncertainty economically, so the rates were going up, so people were, and it got even worse after that, where they were paying double-digit mortgage rates. So those folks wouldn't be happy. We had just come out at the Vietnam War, and it ended a few years earlier before that, Watergate. So, I mean, there was a lot of political uncertainty. But again, it depends on who you are and what context you look at that. If you're a middle-aged person in 1976, and you got a job, you probably were doing okay. Politically, we are still trying to sort things out, again, post-Watergate. It's funny how you look at the lens of Watergate and what's happening now in politics.
Well, we never talked about that quote. I know
anymore?
We're going to talk about J.D. Vance and his appearance on Bill Maher's show in the second hour, but he had a quote last week that we ended up not playing as far as how he... And he's not wrong, right, as far as what Watergate was. And at that point, it was one of the biggest scandals in White House history. And I don't even know what panel he was on when he said this, but he said, you know, today what happened for Watergate probably wouldn't even break through a 12-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's necessarily wrong.
I don't either, which is sort of shocking and stunning. And certainly we've stretched the limits of what's allowable as a elected official or a candidate anymore. So all of those rules have changed. If you're asking me individually, yes, my life's better in this year, 2026, than it was in 1976. Now, I'd like to get those years back, age-wise, because who wants to be 60, almost 68, when you could be, you know, 18? But it's that classic thing. If you have the wisdom of 67 and almost 68 in the body of a 17-and-a-half-year-old, then it's different. But, of course, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
I wasn't sorted out in my brain until I was 25. And I give most of that credit to my
wife. That's even young.
Yeah, I give credit to my wife, Kathy. She sort of straightened me out. Focused me. Yeah, which is something that, again, you want to talk about women and the role of women? That's something women do a lot more than people probably recognize with their relationships. They sort of bring it back on course. Don't you agree?
I totally agree.
Yeah, and why that's not respected more, I don't know. Maybe most guys do. Maybe guys don't talk about it as much as maybe women talk about some of that stuff.
Maybe.
All right, got to take a break. We got a funny, not a funny story, an interesting story about where you live and how long you live and how healthy you are, which is sort of political. We'll get to that and more. If you have a comment on obviously anything that we're talking about, 855-616-1620, the Siding Unlimited WTMJ Talk and Text Line. Love hearing from all of you as we broadcast live from Morningstar, beautiful golf course in Waukesha for the Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. WTMJ Golf Classic. How about that? More next.
Welcome back to the 6th Annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic with Steve and Kristen on Point Taken. We are out here at Morningstar Golf Course. It is beautiful. And I have a couple more minutes before we have to break for the top of the hour news. But I found this CNN analysis that I thought was pretty interesting. So where you live, I think we know this, but specifically your congressional district might say more about your health than you think. So, people in Democratic-held House districts now live about 2 years longer on average than those in Republican-held districts. Republican-held districts were also more likely to have average rates, higher average rates of diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. I thought that was kind of interesting.
What do you think accounts for that?
Well, apparently in the analysis of this, I haven't gotten to dive deep in it, but what they were saying is that in Republican-held districts, they're more increasingly more likely to include rural and small-town communities,
yeah,
which are farther and farther away from healthcare, right, as far as having to drive a long ways to get the care that you need. And then there's also the other thing they were saying as far as, like, smoking prevention programs, expanding Medicaid that have made a difference. But it's this Congressional District Health Board, healthdashboard.org has all of this data if you want to go in and play around with it as far as what they're measuring by congressional district.
Did you see the extremes from 86 in Manhattan, which actually surprises me, to 71 in rural Kentucky, which doesn't surprise me?
The Kentucky doesn't surprise me either. 86 in Manhattan. For
what's going on
intense,
there?
I mean, Manhattan is an intense place to live, especially if you're 86. And the only thing I can imagine is because of walking. Because when you look at some of the communities across the world that have the people who live the longest, it's typically places where those folks walk a lot. And in Manhattan, you walk a lot. And so that's the only thing I can, I mean, there's probably more to it than just that, but off the top of my head, that is what I'm thinking.
Manhattan's money.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Again, it would be interesting to look at the average or the median.
Yeah,
if we look at the median wages of people who live in Manhattan.
Because that generally gives you access to better health care.
Yeah.
Like personalized care.
But yeah, that was very surprising to me that those are the two extremes in there.
Yeah, and one of the things that we'll have countless health care conversations between now and the midterms is access to health care is a big problem. Even in rural Wisconsin, where there's not facilities within a short drive from your home or your apartment or whatever. And that can be life or death in many of these situations. I can remember being on an ice fishing trip. I know we got to get the break here. And we had to take someone for emergency care. It was a long drive
to
the hospital, whatever that town was we went to. It was like a 40-minute drive. That person could have died in that time. And I'm driving, white-knuckling during a snowstorm trying to get that person to
I've die. Had, up in my aunt's cabin, which is like northwest Wisconsin, there's been an annual trips, two different occasions where people needed care, and it was not easy to get it for them.
No. So interesting topic. We'll have to dig deeper on that. All right. We got a whole another hour of Steve and Kristen from the Morningstar Golfers Club, the exciting 6th annual Pellows, Windows, and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic. Golfers are out on the course. I'm watching some of these folks tee off and hit their putts, hopefully hitting their putts. We'll be out on the course in a little bit, meeting all our great partners. And I saw Rose Gray this morning. Looking forward to all of that. It's a great day to be an American. We're celebrating 250 all this week and next, probably. Join us right here on 620 WTMJ. News is next.
E gets weak or particularly numb. S stands for your speech. And lastly, T stands for a terrible headache. So if any one of these things happen, the other part of T in FAST is it's time.
Broadcasting live from the beautiful Morningstar Golfers Club, it's time for a fairway side edition of Point Taken for the 2026 Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Classic. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Oh, indeed. Welcome back. We are here enjoying the weather outside. Not too hot.
No, it's
shockingly
gorgeous.
After.
No, this is fine.
This
it's summer.
This is totally fine. There's a little wind.
Fresh air.
A little sun. Fresh air. We are out here at the Morningstar Golf Course. It is beautiful. We still have an hour left before we get on a cart and go say hi to everyone. show off our swings.
Try not to get hit by a golf ball.
Yeah. Or
errant tee shots.
Mean try not to actually hit the golf ball.
Yeah, well, you don't play golf much.
Not as much as I would like to. It's one of those things. It's one of those aspirational things where it's every time I play, it's like, I wish I was better at this.
Best way to get into golf.
But then it's the priority of actually getting better that I don't have the time for.
You have a busy schedule, but best way to get into golf is join a league. And there's leagues that golf like once a month, so you can actually
well,
do
not
it.
Only that, it's that, but it's also then signing up for like the simulator stuff that's
yeah.
everywhere
I
now.
I play sim golf all winter, so I have some skills left, but I haven't played a lot live. I've played a couple rounds. I'm playing again in a couple weeks up in the Rapids, where you are from.
You mean Bullseye or?
Ridges Golf
Ridges.
Course.
Ridges. Excuse me.
If the folks at Ridges are listening, hello, Gasca family. All right, so we're at the WTMJ Golf Classic, of course. Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin, our great partners who make it all possible. Love hanging out with all the people here, so it's a fun day. Let's talk about politics more.
All right, so I saw this. I actually didn't see this clip going around. So J.D. Vance, who I will say this, as you might imagine, if you listen to this show, I do not agree with J.D. Vance.
On much?
What I will give him credit for before we get into anything that he said is that that guy does show up
everywhere. Absolutely.
He is not afraid to go into the lion's den, including Bill Maher. Granted, his delivery sometimes, some, like me, would say his delivery is like a little smug, but he's there, right? And I think part of our issue today, whether it's our politicians, whether it's each other, of having the uncomfortable conversations and being willing to be asked the hard questions, and maybe you don't have the answer that everyone wants to hear, but at least you're showing up. And I will say, and so he went on Bill Maher, and I think in the opening, Bill asked us, like, thanked him for even coming, because he's like, the people I vote for don't come.
Yeah.
He said AOC won't come, Kamala Harris didn't come, I think Mamdani hasn't come. And so, and, you know, some of that could be schedule or whatever, but I would say hats off to him for showing up and having the conversation.
Two things, without
it always being a friendly...
Yeah. Which is not every conversation anyone has should be always be friendly, because you want to try to figure each other out. Two things. One, obviously he's vying at some point to be a presidential candidate.
Totally. And so he's also selling a book right now. So, but there's a lot of people who don't go
right.
on all the things
that
when
was
they're
my
selling
second
a book.
Point. The second point is this administration, whatever you think about him, if you're left-leaning and you don't like this administration, even Donald Trump, they talk to the media a lot.
Complain about the media a lot, but also talk to the
yeah,
media a lot.
At least they put themselves out there. So you may disagree with everything that they say. They make themselves available. And last time I checked, that was one of the asks of the American public. Where is my elected officials? What are they doing? What are they saying? Well, there they are. So you can't bitch about that. You may not like what you're saying.
Okay, but you did not like one of the things that he said.
No, because I'm gonna hammer this point. I've been hammering it for 6 years now. So let's hear from J.D. Vance with Bill Maher on his program last week.
The biggest criticism I had of the 2020 election is that you had technology companies that were quite literally censoring negative information about the left and promoting negative information about the right. So in a fundamental sense, like if the First Amendment says that we have a free and open debate, and then the American people judge based on that free and open debate, the sense in which I think the election in 2020 was rigged, I'm sorry, is that you had technology companies that were putting their thumb on the scale in a way that completely obliterated the real open exchange of ideas.
Well,
now, by the way, it didn't happen in 2024, but it happened in 2020, and it was a problem.
Well, you're going to get a big pat on the back when you go back to the White House. All
right. Yeah, I mean, that last point, I mean, that's funny, because that's what Donald Trump wants to say. Here's the thing. These are private companies. They can do whatever they want with their algorithms.
But also, like, should we go back to 2016 and all
yeah.
the, like, the Russian influence over, like, the ads that people were seeing? Pending, but I told you a couple weeks ago when I got to interview Scott Walker.
Yeah.
And Scott Walker for the documentary, and he referenced it, right? He talked about 2016 and the Russian, things traced back to Russian operatives influencing our social media spaces. And so there is private companies, there are private actors, there are actors abroad who are influencing our public debate. And that is true. That is different than the elections being rigged.
Yeah. It's this constant banter about 2020 is not helpful to Republicans, because it makes you seem like you're crazy. And whoever does it, whether it's Tom Tiffany does some of the plays in that arena, it's not helpful to winning elections. And Republicans in Wisconsin, last time I checked, are not winning a lot of elections. So state-wise, that's not a good play. But above all else, these things have been challenged over and over again in court. And almost every time, I think there was one that was sort of a draw. Every time these things get shot down, whether you're talking about Dominion and all the crazy stuff of Mike Lindell and all the nonsense he spews, I think he's a candidate for governor in Minnesota now. It's just nonsense. It shows that you're not serious. And America, I think, wants serious politicians who don't just say stuff, they actually do stuff.
Well, and let's come back, because the way this got set up was that Bill Maher had said to J.D. Vance, my vote is open for 2028. This is a guy who I think, I would say he's a centrist, moderate, and gets flack from both sides. But because of some of the things that we've talked about as far as DSA and progressives, Bill Maher is like, I don't know if I'm going to vote for someone like that. But my red line with a Republican and voting for a Republican in 2028 is if they're still into this election denialism stuff. So I think as we talk about, for people who are up for grabs when it comes to their vote, is this for you? Will you vote for someone who will not accept that the 2020 election was free and fair?
I'm under no illusion that Republican strategists or experts listen to me. Maybe some do and some don't. But this is a losing proposition. Stop saying it out loud. Stop going on shows and saying it over and over again. That's 6 years ago. The president won in 2024. Whatever problems you think existed, most of them, I believe, are made up. It all worked in 2024. You can attribute that to what you want to. But 2028 is a different animal, as all presidential elections. This administration, serious Republicans should be focusing on midterms, and they're not. And they're going to get their, you know what, handed to them if they don't start talking seriously. J.D. Vance is not talking like a serious politician when he says stuff like this. What do you think? 855-616-1620, the Siding Unlimited, WTMJ Talk and Text Line. Stephen Christen live from the Morningstar Golfers Club. The 6th annual beautiful Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic. Join us on the air or the stream, wherever. We are broadcasting live from Morningstar Golfers Club in beautiful Waukesha. Beautiful day, not too hot yet. There's obviously extreme heat warning, so be careful. Drink plenty of fluids, which we are doing, although we're going back to coffee.
I will say, I'm not sure this is the most hydrating thing we
could be
drinking.
No, because I feel sweaty now, but I love, and we both love coffee. That's probably why. But I had plenty of water before I started. We're talking about the comments of J.D. Vance on Bill Maher, but really the bigger question is the 2020 election denialism. It's such a buckethead, you know, the term buckethead, just knucklehead, stupid. It's just a dumb thing to talk about. And I know that he asked the question, but I think what J.D. Vance could have done as a potential candidate for the office of president in 2028 is, look, that's the past. We look forward. This is what our administration is doing. And then you could cite some of the things that are positives for Republicans. But he plays in that arena and gets himself mired in it, and I don't like it.
I think it'll be interesting to see what is more powerful, the number of voters who still cling to this idea and their sway over Republican candidates, or President Trump's sway over potential candidates. Because I think as we see Trump get closer and closer to the end of his final term, and, you know, is he a kingmaker, and does it matter as far as his endorsement for candidates after 2020, well, into 2028? But is this a cling, is clinging to this to appease Trump, or is it to more so to appease voters who will not let this go? And I think it'll
be 30%.
Do you think it's more of that? So you think this is, until that 30% of voters who believe this,
until they move on,
until they move on, you think there's going to be a subset of Republican politicians who feel like they can't be honest about it and just say, can we look forward?
Because 30% is a big chunk.
Is it 30%?
That's just my number, anecdotally, but that's my guess.
Have they been done polling on that? Like, how many people still think are convinced that the 2020 election was stolen?
Well, MU Law School poll, that's a great way to sort of revisit that question, because I would be curious to see what their polling would show, and I trust the folks there at MU to find that information out. Look, lots of commentators on this. It's from the 262. It's amazing how things just work when Republicans win, and when Democrats win, it's rigged. That's obviously a common thing that people say. It's interesting. Tom Tiffany, Peter brings this up. Tom Tiffany yesterday started advocating for a complete audit of the Green Bay election operation. He mentioned that when we talked to him about Green Bay specifically, about election denialism, because I said I was just irritated with him bringing it up, and that's why I made it the first question. This idea that there's a lot of things that influence elections. We've talked about, you know, remember the Zuckerbucks thing and all that stuff, and, you know, outside money coming in and influencing how people can vote and, you know, shaping election process. But the bottom line is, because I know a lot of clerks, I was an elected official, I worked with clerks, I've spoken to clerk organizations at the state level. This is one of those things that everybody forgets. When all the voting is done, it comes down to a validation of, these are our voters, they voted or didn't vote, the numbers make sense, therefore we validate the election, confirm the results. It's one person, one vote, and it always has been in this state for the most part, and probably most other states. I can't speak to them because I don't live there. But that's my trust factor, is I know these people. I know the work they do. When they certify an election, I trust those numbers. And I went through recall for a smaller race because I lost by a few votes. They said you should probably do a recall. It didn't change anything.
But I also think, you know, and then what I think it's also gotten us into this position, because as of this morning, I saw a headline that I think there was a mistake in Green Bay.
Yeah.
Right? They send out duplicate.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they're still working the way they're supposed to. They raised their hand and said, we screwed up. We are being transparent. We are being honest. We screwed up. And so it's a double-edged sword where any screw up is a sign that they're incompetent, which they're not. That's not my word. Like, that's someone else's words. But if they were to try to cover it up so people didn't think that they were making mistakes, then it would be a secret. And that would be like, it's like you can't win as far as this is still human error that happens. But it is people who work really hard in the system that we have to make sure, and there is all these fail safes to make sure that things get caught when something goes wrong.
It's the end result. The one person, one vote, certifying the election. A lot of things can happen. We are not perfect beings. We make mistakes. We send out ballots maybe in duplicate, but at the end of the day, at the end of the vote, when they are counted in a clerk's office, I trust the process, and we should all trust the process. And if it worked in 2024, it worked in 2020. The result was different. One a Democrat, one a Republican. Trust the process. And the more people that sort of get on that train to sanity and to not looking back so much, and whether it's 30% or 20%, whatever the number is, stop focusing on that. Because if you're a Republican in Wisconsin and you're not looking forward, you're going to continue to lose elections. And that's not a trend that you probably want to continue. Quick break, 620 WTMJ. Oh, thanks for joining us as we celebrate the 6th annual Halloween of the Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic. It goes between sunny and then cloudy, but keeping the temperature down a little bit. We got a little bit of a breeze. You can probably hear it in the mics, but gorgeous day, summer day.
Do you think you could beat me at a putting contest?
Yeah, probably.
I feel like this, and we're right off the
I see that,
the putting green, and I'm like, that's like the one thing I actually am pretty good at golf.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see that. We'll have to check that out at some point. We're going to be doing some live putting on the course after we finish our show today.
Or maybe mini golf someday.
So we got a couple minutes to tee this up. There's actually some movement on immigrant labor on dairy farms, and we're going to have Brian Reisinger, our friend of the show and smart guy, author, Land Rich Cash Poor, brilliant book on sort of an essay on Wisconsin farming and the challenges of working in that sector. And it's an interesting, you have to give the administration credit. When it benefits a sector, maybe it's a political maneuver, but this is something that farmers have been talking a lot about. That's our workforce. You strip that away, the work doesn't get done. And last time I checked on our license plates, we're America's dairy land. We need those workers. So you can think what you want to think about immigration. I would also remind people, we're all immigrants.
We are all immigrants.
For the most
but
part.
I think this is an interesting, not as highly touted standoff between, obviously, there's a certain sect of the Trump wing of people who want no immigration whatsoever and are not happy about extending legal status for migration workers or migrant workers who work on dairy farms. Obviously, there's a lot of dairy farmers who have been asking for this way before Trump. So it is interesting to see what will happen.
And I think this might be an illustration at some point when Donald Trump finally makes the final understanding that he's not going to run in 2028. He may not care what some MAGA people think about some of this stuff. He may just not care anymore.
What do you think he cares less about, some of the MAGA people or the dairy farmers?
Well, hopefully the MAGA people, because I think the dairy farmers are really important, especially if you're trying to win a state like Wisconsin or California, for that matter. So hopefully he has that understanding. And I'm not of the mindset that says Donald Trump doesn't care about what's going to happen to Republicans in the future. I think he does, because obviously he's talked about Rubio, Secretary of State, and J.D. Vance, and there's some other characters. I wonder what his thoughts are on my favorite Republican who I always wrote in, Nikki Haley. What if he's gotten over that? Do you think he's gotten over that yet? I don't think so.
Probably not. Has he gotten? What's the status with him and Ron DeSantis?
I don't know. Ron's been quiet.
Ron has been quiet.
Yeah. Should look at Florida news.
Do you think he's going to run again?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Fairly quiet for someone who's going to run again in 28.
He'll put some fresh lifts in his shoes and get ready to hit the campaign trail.
Because he's done. He's term limited, and that's done at the end of this year.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's an interesting story as well. All right, got local news updates. And Brian Reisinger, author of Land Rich, Cash Poor.
Love Welcome back to Point Taken. We are at Morningstar Golf Course out in Waukesha, and it is the 6th annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Classic Golf Outing. We're going to be, WTMJ is going to be out here all day doing shows live after we got a half hour left, and then Steve and I are getting on a golf course,
whack
golf,
some
golf
shots.
Cart. And
Looking forward to it.
Go have some fun. But right now, friend of the show, Brian Reisinger. Brian, it's been a minute, but I'm excited because one of the things we talk a lot about on this show is the influence and impact of AI. And one of the things I had not thought about is the impact of AI in rural areas and on farmers. But you, in one of your more recent op-eds for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talked exactly about the threat that it poses. So talk to us a little bit about what got you, what you've been seeing or experiencing that wanted you, maybe want to write about this.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you hear about all the ways that AI is supposed to affect white-collar workers and the knowledge-based economy and all these things, and I thought, you know, boy, all those things are going right over flyover country, and I thought, what is the impact on the rural workforce, rural parts of our state of Wisconsin here that affects everything from our food prices to our environment and all these other issues. So I dug into it and I started looking at stories throughout my family's history where the rural workforce, the places that I came from, really impacted our economy and the economy impacted us, you know, my great aunt, my grandpa, etc. And I looked at some research by some MIT researchers and others, and here's what I found. It's a pretty shocking thing. AI is actually in a place to entirely gut our rural economy in a way that we are completely overlooking. And there's reasons for why, but the basic reason is it would take all the trends going on in our economy around the consolidation of different industries and put them on hyperdrive. And that'll wipe out more farms, it'll wipe out more opportunities for our rural workforce in terms of the trades, all kinds of things that we're not talking about right now. So people are talking about data centers as it pertains to rural Wisconsin.
Right.
But they're not talking about what's going to happen to the workers. So I thought somebody ought to do that.
So what gets in the way of that? Because obviously farming and the rural communities of Wisconsin matter to all of us who live here. And it's not just Wisconsin. Other states depend on that sector as well. What gets in the way of stopping that rush, the explosion of AI that's going to hamper this sector?
Here's what it is. We've got to make deliberate decisions about how we use AI. And I'm going to explain a concept that is a little bit interstellar for just a second, so bear with me. The notion here is as AI goes to AGI, artificial general intelligence, what that is that's when AI can start making its own decisions, learning on its own, applying that knowledge. That's like when the robots come alive is like the way I jokingly put it, although it might not be all that funny. We'll see. So in that moment, what's going to happen is it allows a handful of companies to get their arms around basically the entirety of human knowledge. So you think about every time you get a couple of companies to get their arms around an industry, you get a couple of companies to get their arms around our food industry, you get a couple of companies to get their arms around manufacturing or whatever it is, it drives consolidation, right? It wipes out small businesses and it concentrates power. If we have that happen with our knowledge-based economy, it's going to affect the way we use all of our technology. So for farms, for instance, and I can get into the other parts of the rural workforce, farms is a good example. One of the biggest problems we have with our farms, in addition to the government screwing things up, in addition to all kinds of economic crises we've never understood properly, I've told you guys before, is technology, right? Do we have technology that can be scale neutral, meaning it can work for small and mid-sized as well as large farms? Or do we just have more technology that's making farmers add more field rows, larger buildings, more and more farms can't afford to innovate and they get wiped out? If AGI continues on the course that it's on, it's just going to turn into hyperdrive, having more technology that forces our farms to get bigger, as opposed to how do we create technology that can help farms of all sizes and types innovate? We could reprogram AI to do that if we wanted to, but if we don't make the deliberate choice, we're going to wipe more of them out.
So just so I understand the argument, or what you're seeing, is it's that the technology that could be applied to farms will be too big, too expensive for everyone to be able to access it, and then it will gain, the people who can afford it will gain an even bigger competitive advantage, which will change prices and then drive out the folks who couldn't afford that technology?
That's exactly right. And that same concept also applies to rural manufacturing, the trades, and others. Let's take rural manufacturing. Already been getting wiped out by automation. Already been getting wiped out by offshoring. If we have AI focused on, hey, how do we make these companies more productive without needing labor, which is basically what AI is focusing on right now, right? How do you create more productivity, more value, and having lower costs, less people needing to do it? If we add that trend on top of the automation and the offshoring that's already occurring, we're going to wipe out more of our rural workforce as it pertains to factories, all kinds of industries. So whether it's farms, factory floors, whatever it is, if we don't use AI the right way, it's going to put all of our worst economic trends on steroids.
Okay, so let's take a break really quickly. We're talking to Brian Reisinger, author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, and talking about the AI, something you probably haven't thought about, because I didn't, of AI's impact on rural areas. I want to ask you when we come back about what your fix is. Is it a government regulation fix? Is it just a plea to the technology companies that are making this? So we'll talk to him about his solutions and about Trump's new allowing dairy farmers to have a path for migrant labor. So we'll talk about all of that with Brian Reisinger on Point Taken after this. Welcome back to Point Taken. We are out at Morningstar Golf Course for the Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Classic Golf Outing. Steve, Kristen, and we are talking to Brian Reisinger, author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, and author of two
great
articles, op-eds in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talking about the AI threat to Wisconsin's rural areas. And the previous segment, we talked a little bit about what the threat is. But Brian, what are some of your solutions? Because I have to imagine, knowing you, an overreach from government is not necessarily your go-to solution for things. So what do you think is actually the fix here?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's a mix of market and government solutions. And here's the basic premise. We need to move decisions about how AI is used on our economy, particularly our rural workforce, out of Silicon Valley into the heartland. And part of that might be people in Silicon Valley with a lot of these companies developing this stuff coming into rural communities and seeing how the local economy and workforce work and how it affects things like food prices and other things that we're all going to care about later so they don't screw it up further. But the other part of it is small businesses, the UW, anybody who has an opportunity to implement AI or research the use of AI should be focused on how do we create a way for current workforce in rural America to not be eliminated to increase productivity. We don't just increase productivity by like getting rid of costs, but to actually have their capabilities increased. So you can increase productivity in the economy by two ways. You can cut costs and just keep on producing more with less, or you can find a way to have more skilled workers, whether they're on farms or whether they're in factory floors or wherever, able to do new things, more things that allow their companies to innovate what they're doing, expand into new markets, grow that pie. So that's the basic premise. And just to unpack a little bit of the way that you can do that, we talked about farm technology in the last segment. Focus on using AI to develop technology that can work for farms of all sizes, small and medium as well as large. There's other things. You know, figure out how to make a factory floor more efficient to be able to use workers to be able to do more things at once. And don't just, you know, eliminate a worker because you got someone next door who can do the same thing. Find a new way to use those workers. AI can help do that. It can project and really help small businesses do that. The other thing is the government plays a role, but they need to find a way to get money in people's pockets for this transition, because no matter what we do, it is going to be bumpy. So how do you, through tax cuts, through things like wage insurance and other programs, find a way to get people to have a little more money in their pockets so they can make this transition and retool for being able to work on into the future with AI as an extension of them rather than an emplacement?
Brian, I often look to you as the guy who gives us a status report on the state of American farming, especially Midwest farming. We have a lot of listeners who are Wisconsin dairy farmers and other kinds of farmers, obviously in northern Illinois as well. Since we last talked, which is probably a few months ago, what's the current state of affairs? What are they talking about? I know that we talked a lot about the tariff impact and fertilizer problems, getting those through the Strait of Hormuz. Where are we at right now?
Yeah, the hope is that if goods can keep moving through the Strait of Hormuz and, you know, trade issues can settle down, the hope is that some of the shocks to the system that farmers were seeing can settle down. Now, the deeper issues are still there. We're still, all the big picture structural things that were making us lose tens of thousands of farms a year for the past several decades, they're still there, right? These other issues we're talking about, they're flare-ups, they add to it, but they didn't create it. So what we still have is farms that in general in Wisconsin have higher input costs, higher costs that it takes for them to produce their crops and products, and the price that they're getting for the most part is staying the same or going down. Corn is still the price it was when I was a little kid, you know? So those forces are still there, Steve. It's still tough, but farmers, I think, are hoping that there's a little bit of breathing room with progress on the Iran front and progress on folks like China buying and soybeans while we figure out a long-term strategy with what to do with that country.
And potentially some progress on the status of migrant labor. So let's talk about that. Let's take one more break. Brian Reisinger is with us. He will talk a little bit more about Trump's allowing dairy farmers a path for migrant labor and what the status of that would, what would that mean if it actually goes forward. I'm Kristen, he's Steve, and this is Point Taken. All right. That it just about does it.
Yeah.
Does it for us, for Steve and I on Point Taken at the 6th Annual Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin WTMJ Golf Outing. But we are finishing up talking to our friend Brian Reisinger, because we were going to talk about this. I saw this earlier this week, that the Trump administration opened up a new legal pathway for migrant farm workers, which was, there was a pretty aggressive lobbying campaign from the dairy industry about this topic specifically. Obviously, this is at odds with the anti-immigration part of this base, we'll say. To me, this seems like a good thing. I think most of us agree that legal immigration is a good thing, and people who want to work, and especially want to do the jobs that a lot of us don't want to do, is a good thing. But what are you hearing about this, Brian?
Yeah, so, you know, farmers live a reality where, on the one hand, look, I mean, a good amount of President Trump's support comes from rural communities, farming areas. Many of these folks voted for the president. They may or may not have voted for the president in part because of his immigration agenda. Some of them, others not, right? But so a lot of folks from these areas might believe in securing the border, which, depending on how you're doing it, is at times either a bipartisan goal or a thing more on the right. Depends upon kind of the policy proposal, right? But a lot of these farmers agree with that goal, but they also depend upon migrant labor to be able to milk cows, especially as our farms are forced to get bigger and bigger. Here's what this policy does. There's a lot of things going on here, but one of them is it said, hey, we've got H-2A visas, a legal farm visa worker program. Let's make it so that dairy farms can be eligible for it throughout the year and deal with a kind of a seasonal exception that had excluded a lot of dairy farms. So making that policy change just allows dairy farms to be able to use more of those farm visa workers who are here legally, have a way to be able to be here with a legal status. And so that's a step forward for farmers. And for them, it's not necessarily at odds to say they believe in securing the border, whether you agree with that or not, and that they also need this labor. Those are realities they live with.
That sounds like compromise to me, Brian. And for a group of people, one, that want to know with some certainty what their future is, but two, for an industry that needs help, and they need it, like, right now.
Yeah, well, you know, you used the compromise word that's been banished from our discussion, right? But, you know, look, the reality is, I think, that a lot of people that are strong supporters or strong opponents of President Trump, you can actually break down these issues, get them out of the partisan framework, and say, hey, here's a goal. Can we get to that goal? There's actually a lot of ways to do that. There's many ways to meet the legal workforce needs in this country and secure the border. And we often don't get to those conversations. This is one of those that whatever people on the right or the left in your listenership think about President Trump, I hope they can see that this step is something that can help farmers, whether all those farmers agree on other parts of the immigration issue with your listeners or not. This is something that is a workforce reality.
And it's happened, right? Like, this isn't a debate. Like, it happened, whether it's there was a lot of press around it or not. It is a done deal.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about, okay, is he doing it now because of politics and all, you know, all this stuff? And we can talk about the midterm elections, and we can talk about the economic drivers of what's going to be happening this fall. And I do think the Republicans need to take that very, very seriously in rural communities where they get a lot of their support. They can't have their turnout down, and they can't have, you know, the occasional person voting for a blue-collar Democrat who thinks going to fight for them, which there is a little bit of capacity for in a lot of these rural communities. They were voting for those folks not too long ago. So these areas aren't going to flip, but the Republicans do need to take this seriously. But whether there's politics going into it or not, it's something that can help dairy farms that are producing milk and other products in this state that is an important part of our economy and affects things like the price for all the consumers out there. So there's kind of a real world actual impact discussion to be had regardless of politics.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about that the next time you're on, as far as your analysis going into the midterms, because they're not that far away. But
coming.
Brian Reisinger, as always, love having you on the show and love having your insight.
Appreciate you, Brian.
Good to be with you. Thanks, guys.
All right. We're wrapping up our show. We got Greg and Jessica coming up live from the Morningstar Golfers Club in Waukesha, the 6th annual WTMJ Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin Golf Classic. We're going to hit the course, hit some shots, see what happens, hopefully not hurt ourselves in the process. The news is next on 620 WTMJ.